New Letters on the Air has been produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City since 1977. Our extensive archives give insight into literary history, as in today's show, shaped from two interviews with former U.S. and Mississippi Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey. We present this on the heels of the 2018 restaging of Native Guard, her Pulitzer Prize-winning poetry book at the Atlanta History Center. She shares how looking back fuels her work.
I get interested in something historical, and obviously, without me even having to think about it, it's connected to one of my obsessions.
Discover more about the obsessions of our 19th U.S. Poet Laureate in the second part of a 2015 interview recorded in front of an audience at the University of Kansas Hall Center for the Humanities. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with Natasha Trethewey about the aftermath of her two-term laureateship in D.C. when she returned full-time to Atlanta, Georgia, where she taught at Emory University for 15 years until 2017, the year she joined the faculty of Illinois Northwestern University and won a Heinz Award for Arts and Humanities. But for this member of the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame, her third book, Native Guard, that intertwines Civil War history of Mississippi Black regiments with her own racially mixed past and the tragic murder of her mother, will always be connected to Atlanta since it's twice been staged there.
A theatrical installation, they called it. And it was wonderful. There were two actors, a woman who played the poet, and then a second actor who played the Native Guard. So there was a young man who recited the poems of the soldier. And then there was a vocalist whose voice is lovely, who brought some of the epigraphs that are from music out for us to hear, and a composer. They did a beautiful set. They didn't do a dramatization. It was literally just reading the book from its start to finish with this woman out there who is me reading this whole book. But so many people saw it. And this is one of the reasons that I agreed to go along with it, because my first thought was, well, I think I read my poems really well. Why would we need anyone to do that? But what convinced me was that there are so many other things that you can bring to it with a theatrical installation. When I quote Nina Simone's song, Mississippi Goddamn, I just quote the line, everybody knows about Mississippi. If you don't know the song, it's not going to bring it to your mind at all. And when I use the lines from Poor Wayfaring Stranger, that's such a haunting tune to me, but you may just read the words and not feel the music or hear it. So they bring that to it. There were photographs that were sort of swirling around, an image that looked like a train. But the last thing is that there are audiences who they told me were, and I believe this, were still a little bit gun shy about picking up a book of poems, but they would go to the theater. And so it brought a whole other audience to my poems than would have been there before. And I think a lot of them then bought books afterwards, but it was the theater that did that.
What a great idea.
It was wonderful.
Who was the creator of that?
So Susan Booth, who was the director of the Alliance. Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Creative director.
The Alliance Theater. I've been able to interview Natasha already. I talked to her right after you won the Pulitzer Prize in 2007 mm-hmm. for her third book, Native Guard. And her other two books before that, Domestic Work and Bellexophilia, had also gotten a lot of acclaim. Rita Dove chose her first book for the Cave Canem Prize, and she has continued marching on in that vein. She was chosen as the Poet Laureate of the United States and served in Washington, actually kept office hours.
Right.
Which is an unusual thing, I think. A lot of poets laureate are there for readings occasionally, but aren't in-house.
Right. It was kind of a very old-school thing to do. I think that they told me that the last time someone had really kept office hours was back when it was still the consultantship, before they changed it in 1986 to the laureateship, and it was the last consultant, Gwendolyn Brooks.
How perfect is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm curious about that relationship to the poet laureateship, how that has modified you in any way or made you more aware of your public?
Well, I think that once I was charged with trying to promote poetry to a wider audience, it was a charge I couldn't just put down once I was done. So when the New York Times approached me in the fall to ask if I would edit this new column in the redesigned New York Times magazine, a very short column introducing a poem each week with a very brief introduction, I thought I couldn't say no. I'm certainly busy enough to need to have said no. But it was a big deal that the New York Times wanted to feature poetry. So I thought, this is a way to continue to do that kind of service, to make sure that poems are getting out there in venues that have a wide readership.
It's really wonderful. Well, we should let people know, too, that it's only a year long,
right? That's right.
Are you thinking about the variety of poems I want to present, or are you just dealing with it on a week-by-week basis?
I have a lot of stacks of books that have arrived at my house, and I try to go through them and find poems that stand out to me that, of course, are short because we have space limitations. And then there are poets whose poems I've already chosen that seem right for later on, for certain periods during the year that it might be better to publish those. So, you know, 52 poems I've got to select.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey finished with the New York Times in 2016, but her 52 choices are still online. For a link, go to our website, newletters.org. We'll return to this conversation in a moment, but first, let's listen to a poem for her birthplace, now included in her book, Beyond Katrina, A Meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. This was unpublished when she read it in our earlier 2008 interview, while she was a guest of Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series. We couldn't fit it into that show, but now it's found a place in this edition of New Letters on the Air. Again, here's Natasha Trethewey.
Liturgy for the Mississippi Gulf Coast. To the security guard staring at the gulf, thinking of bodies washed away from the coast, plugging her ears against the bells and sirens, sound of alarm, the gaming floor on the coast. To Billy Scarpetta, waiting tables on the coast, staring at the gulf, thinking of water rising, thinking of New Orleans, thinking of cleansing the coast. To the woman dreaming of returning to the coast, thinking of water rising, her daughter's grave, my mother's grave, underwater on the coast. To Miss Mary, somewhere. To the displaced, living in trailers along the coast, beside the highway, in vacant lots and open fields, to everyone who stayed on the coast, who came back or cannot to the coast, to those who died on the coast. This is a memory of the coast, to each his own recollections, her reclamations, their restorations, the return of the coast. This is a time capsule for the coast, words of the people, don't forget us, the sound of wind, waves, the silence of graves, the muffled voice of history, bulldozed and buried under sand, poured on the eroding coast, the concrete slabs of rebuilding the coast. This is a love letter to the Gulf Coast, a praise song, a dirge, invocation and benediction, a requiem for the Gulf Coast. This cannot rebuild the coast. It is an indictment, a complaint, my logos, argument and discourse with the coast. This is my nostos, my pilgrimage to the coast, my memory, my reckoning, native daughter, I am the Gulf Coast.
Liturgy for the Mississippi Gulf Coast, from the book of poetry and essays Beyond Katrina. It's also included in her 2014 poetry chapbook, Congregation, winner of the William Meredith Award for Poetry. We'll return now to KU's Hall Center for the Humanities and the 2015 interview with then-Mississippi Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey.
There are a lot of poets now that are taking on historical subjects. I think we see that a lot more in collections. The difficulty is in what stories we're telling. That was part of my experience in graduate school. I got the sense that there were people who weren't interested in the particular stories that I had to tell. And, you know, I wrote an essay about this myself. One of my teachers in graduate school said to me, when I was trying to write poems out of my own experience and to examine my experience within this context of history that I should unburden myself of being black, unburden myself of the death of my mother, and write about the situation in Northern Ireland. Because this was someone who wasn't really interested in the story that I had to tell, but, you know, the story about Northern Ireland would be so much more interesting. Well, instead I wrote Native Guard. But it was Irish poets who helped me do it. The work of Evan Boland, Seamus Heaney's North, helped me figure out how to write about my South. When I was writing Native Guard, I was reading his collection, North, and the title poem, North. And I think that book and that poem in particular, more than anything, gave me a way to contend with what I felt about my South, the troubled history of my South, and my place in it. The way that he also deals with history, his belief about the redress of poetry, poetry's potential for justice, I think that we're still confronted with that. The other thing I was thinking about was the poet who said that black writers will write better poems when they stop writing about black experience. And I don't know how many white poets have ever been told that.
That's incredible. I love the way you intertwine personal stories with the greater history out there. You did that so well in Native Guard. You've done that in Beyond Katrina.
Thank you. I got interested in writing about those black soldiers because of this historical erasure that I had come to recognize. And that happened because I was going out to the fort at Ship Island, which is a place that I'd gone every year my whole life to celebrate the 4th of July with my grandmother. And at no point during any of our trips out there did the park ranger say anything about the black soldiers who'd been stationed on the island. There's a monument out there listing the names of all the Confederate soldiers who were on the island and who died there, but nothing about, well, not only the black soldiers, but nothing about the Union soldiers who were there at all. And if you didn't know to ask about it, you weren't going to be told. And so when I found out about it, I was visiting my grandmother to take her out to lunch at a restaurant on the beach. And I was telling her about an assignment I was going to give my creative writing students, just an assignment to write about the time that someone in your family met somebody famous. We all have stories like that. And I often do the assignments with my students, and I was going to do it too, because my grandmother had told me stories about her brother who had been a bellhop at a hotel on the beach who shook Al Capone's hand. Al Capone used to come down to the Mississippi Gulf Coast to do some offshore gambling. And in my grandmother's mind, she thought that Ship Island was where he was doing this offshore gambling. It was really another barrier island that is long since submerged. But anyway, these sort of things came together, this sort of family story. Well, this woman overhears me talking about this, and she leans over before she leaves the restaurant, and she says, "There's something else you need to know about Ship Island." And she told me about these black soldiers. And so immediately there was this connection. There was my grandmother's story. There was me going out to this island and never knowing anything about this history, not only as a black child growing up in Mississippi, but an American child growing up in Mississippi for whom this is part of our significant history. So it begins there with me trying to tell that. It takes a lot longer before I find out that this is also about not remembering properly someone else. And I only got to that by looking at history. I think that's how I approach writing poems all the time. I get interested in something historical, and obviously, without me even having to think about it, it's connected to one of my obsessions. I mean, you know, we have these obsessions, and not until I start doing the research and writing poems do I begin to understand how that history was leading me back to my own obsessions.
Native Guard may be the book that brought national acclaim to Natasha Trethewey, but it wasn't her first obsession with history. The Mississippi Native was educated at the University of Georgia, then Hollins College in Virginia, and finally the University of Massachusetts Amherst. While at Hollins, she studied under her father, the Canadian-born white poet Eric Trethewey. After divorce from Natasha's Mississippi-born black mother, he had lived in New Orleans for a time, the setting for Natasha's earlier book, which we talked about back in 2008. There wasn't enough time for this and that new Letters on the Air show, so I'm happy to share it with you now. Belloc Ophelia is your second book of poems, and this one's really intriguing too because you also touch on the issue of mixed race, and some of these poems are beautifully narrative. I mean, I just was really taken with this book as a whole. It's definitely a book that you sit down and you start and you don't want to put it down until you're finished
with it.
Another thing that I noticed in your work, because this one is based on some photographs, and then you made up stories around the photographs, but photos come up in your work here and there.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about this, and then I might have you read one of these.
I first saw Belloc's photographs when I was in graduate school. I was in an American Studies class, and the professor, Judith Davidow, writes about photography. And the first day of class, she showed a bunch of slides of different photographers from, you know, Steiglitz to Cindy Sherman. And Belloc was somewhere in there also. I was just taken with them immediately. And I ran to the library after class because one of the images that she had shown reminded me of the cover of my ninth grade Hamlet text. And for me, that was really how the project started, that I made this connection between John Everett Millais' painting Ophelia and this photograph of Belloc's. So I sat down in the stacks right there and started writing what became the title poem of the book. And the rest of the semester, and even as I was at UMass for a while after that, I was doing a lot of research about the photographs, about the historical moment in which they were taken, about New Orleans, about art. That's when I came across Janet Malcolm's essay, The Real Thing, and also the introduction that she wrote for the most recent edition of the photographs, in which she talks about how we would know any of the women in the photographs are actually prostitutes. And she went in search of evidence that they were indeed prostitutes. And she talks about finding out from a photographer in New Orleans that one of the ways that they know that those are portraits from brothels is that there's wallpaper that appears in the background that was famous wallpaper from Mahogany Hall, which was one of the mixed-race brothels. And so this is how we know they're prostitutes. For me, it was also how we know they're mixed race. And so from there, I began to imagine the life of this woman who would have lived in Storyville around 1912.
And you created a great character. I know that the poem Storyville Diary won an award. This comes later in the book. It's in the third section. But in a way, it sets up the main character, Ophelia, when she's en route in 1910. So I thought I'd have you read that.
Sure. Storyville Diary, naming, en route, October 1910. I cannot now remember the first word I learned to write. Perhaps it was my name, Ophelia, in tentative strokes, a banner slanting across my tablet at school or inside the cover of some treasured book. Leaving my home today, I feel even more the need for some new words to mark this journey, like the naming of a child, queen, lovely, hope, marking even the humblest beginnings in the shanties. My own name was a chant over the washboard, a song to guide me into sleep. Once my mother pushed me toward a white man in our front room. Your father, she whispered, he's the one that named you, girl.
Storyville Diary from Natasha Trethewey's second book, Belux Ophelia, winner of the 2003 Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters Book Prize, recorded when she was at Rockhurst University's 2008 Midwest Poet Series. Now we'll go back to the 2015 conversation at KU's Hall Center for the Humanities. Can you talk a little bit about narrative poetry in American poetics right now? Because it seems like there's a lot going on with telling a narrative, but telling it in very different ways that can be, to me, less accessible. And one of the things I appreciate about your work is the narrative quality within the poetry itself. Mm-hmm. I personally adore that.
Me too.
You're my kind of poet.
Thank you. I mean, I try to tell narrative in different ways. I try to be nonlinear, for example.
Which is fine, because that's how our brains work anyway.
Because I am a little bit afraid of my own tendency for a kind of pedestrian narrative poem. And so, you know, I try to use the elements of lyric to tell the story in a different way. And I think it actually makes for a more interesting story sometimes if I, for example, a pantoum that's about the Klan burning a cross on my family's yard, but it's told in such a way that you keep returning to a certain idea and not necessarily the incident itself. Several years ago, I was the editor of Best New Poets, which is an anthology of younger poets or poets who haven't yet published a first book. And when I was reading the submissions, I think the initial editors gave me about 100 poems or so to choose from. I assumed that because of my own taste, that I would go straight for the straightforward narrative poems. But what I found was that many of them fell flat. Many of them were what I feared in my own work, which is sort of being pedestrian. And so I found myself being drawn a little bit more to poems that I couldn't quite figure out. I'm not comfortable with that all the time, but they were doing more interesting things with language sometimes or with image. And I mentioned this to my friend C. Dale Young, who was the editor of New England Review and had been
and also a fabulous
and
poet.
And a wonderful poet. And I was perplexed about it, so I mentioned it to him one day, and he said, well, it's just because narrative poems are so hard. It's really hard to write a narrative poem and for it to be good, to rise above the story that it has to tell. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe people find it less hard to tell a story or to try to find other ways to tell a story that end up not quite telling the story, but focusing on something else. You know, I often have my poetry students make word lists. And these are just lists of words that you love or you're drawn to or you have some kind of ownership over for some reason. And it may be changing often. If I made lists of words that I owned in Native Guard and words I own in Thrall, there'd be a little bit of overlap, but then there's some differences as well. These are words that I feel like both consciously and unconsciously I am living with and mulling over. Once I begin to see in a collection, and this is the intentionality part, I begin to see them as tropes. Sometimes they arrive sort of unbidden, but other times, once I can step back and look at what I've been doing, I can use them again and again. The words light and dark throughout Thrall appear quite a bit. The words grave and stone and cotton appear a whole lot in Native Guard, probably along with a few others. What I like is the idea that if you read good books, you read the dictionary for fun, then you develop this list of words that you're not even thinking about that you may not have cause to use on an everyday basis. And yet when you sit down to write, this happens to me, a word will arrive, I think, unbidden. And I write it down and I think, well, that's interesting. And I immediately go to the dictionary. And I'm always surprised to see that it is the just right word for its primary definition, but it's even more the right word for what else it means. And I think you only get that way because you spend a lot of time with language. You spend a lot of time reading books and hanging out with the dictionary.
I thought I would have you end with a poem that ends the collection Thrall, mm-hmm. called Illumination. Mm-hmm. Would you like to read that?
Sure.
I think in a way it's a nice tie to what we've been discussing about history and memory. And
yeah. I have to tell you something about this poem right before I read it too, because it's connected to being here. This is probably one of the first poems I wrote for Thrall, and I wrote it because I had checked out a book at the library. I don't call the book in here a library book, but you know that now. And it was heavily annotated. You know, you see them all the time, right? You know, people have written in the books. The book that it was an early collection of poems by Jory Graham called Hybrids of Plants and of Ghosts. And I love this book. And I didn't own it, so I checked it out. Then I ended up reading all of these kind of illumination around the text that someone has left there for me. But yesterday, when I had some time, when I first got here, I went to the used bookstore in town, and lo and behold, a copy of that book. So now I own it. And it was not written in.
Yeah.
Illumination. Always there is something more to know. What lingers at the edge of thought, awaiting illumination, as in this second-hand book, full of annotations, daring the margins in pencil, a light stroke as if the writer of these small replies meant not to leave them forever, meant to erase evidence of this private interaction. Here, a passage underlined, there, a single star on the page, as in a night sky, cloud-swept and hazy, where only the brightest appears, a tiny spark. I follow its coded message, try to read in it the direction of the solitary mind that thought to pencil in a jagged arrow. It is a bolt of lightning. Where it strikes, I read the line over and over, as if I might discern the little fire set, the flames of an idea licking the page, how knowledge burns. Beyond the exclamation point, its thin agreement, angle of surprise, there are questions, the word why. So much is left untold. Between the printed words and the self-conscious scrawl, between what is said and not, white space framing the story, the way the past, unwritten, eludes us. So much is implication. The afterimage of measured syntax, always there, ghosting the margins that words, their black-lined authority, do not cross. Even as they rise up to meet us, the white page hovers beneath, silent, incendiary, waiting.
Lovely. Natasha, thank you very much.
Thank you, Angela.
Appreciate it. Natasha Trethewey, winner of the 2017 Heinz Award for Arts and Humanities, reading from her book, Thrall, published in 2012, the year she became Poet Laureate for both the United States and Mississippi. This segment was recorded as part of KU's Hall Center for the Humanities 2015 lecture series. For links to the rest of that conversation or the 2008 interview, visit newletters.org. Today's show was originally produced with Jamie Walsh, Coy Duggar, Elizabeth Albano, Cassie Vaughn, Danny Moran, and Renita Johnson, and the 2008 segments with Danette Alexander, Colin Pritchett, and Dennis Conroe. From New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.